Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Medicine, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Rachel Pagonis, and I'm your host for this episode. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. John Richens about his new book, Tick Meraki, An Epidemic Like No Other, published by Melbourne University Press in March of 2022. John Richens is regarded internationally as a leading expert on the sexually transmitted infection, donovanosis. He studied classics and medicine at King's College, Cambridge, and King's College, London, and then tropical medicine at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. His interest in donovanosis was sparked by patients he encountered while working in the highlands of Papua New Guinea from 1984 to 1990. After returning to the UK, he became an academic specialist in HIV and sexually transmitted infections at University College London and overseas as a consultant to the World Health Organization and other aid agencies. Well, John, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's great to be doing my first podcast in relation to this book.
Well, you're a wonderful guest to have here speaking about your very interesting book. And the book sprang from your personal experience as a physician in Papua New Guinea. Would you tell us how that came about and how you came to write the book some years later?
I remember as a child noticing New Guinea on a map because it has this extraordinary contour of a bird, and you could almost think that there must have been an intelligent designer creating the most beautiful birds in the world, the birds of paradise, and then putting them into an island with the shape of a bird. But the next big step forward for me and my interest in New Guinea came when I was a medical student at Cambridge University. And the most memorable lecture that I recall from that time was on the subject of what was called slow viruses. That was the early 1970s. And these were intriguing diseases because they were clearly transmissible, but they had no identifiable transmissible agent, no bacteria, no viruses, but they behave like infectious diseases. And the most famous example, in fact, the first example of this type of disease to be described was Kuru, which is a disease that caused an epidemic of a neurological disease in a remote part of the New Guinea highlands. And the most extraordinary feature of this illness was the mode of transmission, which was through the consumption of human brain by women and children during funeral rituals of the foray people. So I just found this extraordinary that there's this bizarre disease occurring in this remote place. And I thought this must be an amazing place to practice medicine. And then later on as a medical student, I had to choose where to go for my elective medical period. And I loved travel. I spent all my summers hitchhiking around Europe and North Africa. And so I chose West Africa, Côte d'Ivoire, and went to a small mission hospital. And that was my first taste of work in the developing country. And I worked in a small hospital where all the doctors had to have all-round skills. And I thought, this is what I want. I want to work in a developing country. I want to practice something like all-round medicine. So I then sort of set out to acquire the necessary skills. And at one point I went to the London School of Hygiene of Tropical Medicine to do a master's course in clinical tropical medicine. And my mentor on this course was Dr. Carl Hugo Ray, and he'd worked in New Guinea. He highly recommended it as a place to start a career in tropical medicine. And he had contacts in the health department. So he fixed me up with a job there. And I had a contract for 3 years. I loved it so much, I spent nearly 7 years there in total. And before I went, we had a chat about research opportunities. He says, you're going to encounter this disease called Donovanosis. It's, nobody knows anything about it. It's very neglected. You know, that would be a great topic for you to choose for research. So I took that advice. And the first step to writing this book was actually unearthing an unpublished manuscript about this epidemic that affected the Marind people in Dutch New Guinea in the beginning of the 20th century. And I translated this and had it published in the local medical journal. And then in 1990, I came back to the UK and I began to use the story as a case study. And that prompted me to sort of delve into it in more depth. There was no pressure to write a book, but a very strong impulse to try and understand the context of this epidemic. And my father was something of a role model, because my father only wrote one book in his lifetime. He spent best part of 30, 40 years collecting data for it. It was the definitive monograph on the elm tree. And it covered every conceivable aspect. It covered the botany, it covered the insects that associated with the tree. And then it went on to look at the tree in literature, in art, in words for elm in different languages and so on. And so he was definitely a sort of my inspiration. That there was no hurry, that it was great. It would be great to explore all aspects of this topic before sitting down to write about it. And when the lockdown came, I had this mass of material and I thought, well, it's time to finally pull it all together and try and find a publisher, which was not particularly easy, because it is a very esoteric subject in a part of the world that's remote from you know, the Western world. So that's essentially the story of why it took so long to write the book and how I got to New Guinea.
Well, that's quite a role model, your dad.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Yeah. The elm tree story. So as you noted, this is a history as well as a story of a disease. But let's just begin with, would you explain what Donovanosis, which as I may or may not have mentioned, is also known as granuloma inguinale, particularly in the United States, what it is and how it compares to maybe better known sexually transmitted diseases like chlamydia and syphilis. Yeah, I was just going to go ahead, and then I'll ask my follow-up.
Yeah, so I mean, you've picked a good pair there, chlamydia and syphilis. So they represent the two of the main classes of sexually transmitted disease. Chlamydia causes discharges either from the penis or from the cervix in women, whereas syphilis is an ulcerative disease. So Donovanosis belongs in the ulcerative disease category. It causes ulcers in the genital area, in men and women. But its distinguishing feature is that the infection spreads to the lymph glands in the groin, and then it often will erupt through the skin above those glands, giving very characteristic lesions that, you know, if you know the disease, are quite unmistakable. It's potentially a very chronic disease. Without treatment, it can go on for months or even years. And then there are various complications that occur in neglected cases. So for men, the most fearsome one is that the penis can actually drop off if the ulcers actually surround the base of the penis. In women, it can extend from the cervix up into the tubes and affect the ovaries. So that doesn't happen very often. It's rarely fatal, but if a woman is pregnant when she contracts the disease and has it on the cervix, during childbirth, the cervix can tear and the organisms can then enter the bloodstream and disseminate widely with fatal outcome. So the bacteria involved here are called, it's a Klebsiella, an intracellular Klebsiella. In terms of its current extent, the disease was once common in the southern USA until about 1950, and it's pretty much vanished from there. It's very little seen in Africa now, but it does hang on in parts of South America, in parts of India, and I think probably New Guinea is the most endemic area left in the world now. It was widely seen among the Aboriginal population in Australia, but it's been successfully eradicated from there. So it's a disease that's a candidate for global eradication, but because it occurs in mostly in very poor countries with poor health services, health priorities in those countries tend to be focused on more important conditions. You can treat it easily. It responds to a lot of broad spectrum antibiotics. So today, finding a treatment is not difficult. And if it's treated early on, it never progresses very far. But at the time of my book, so early 20th century, there were no antibiotics. And the only treatment that was available was a rather toxic heavy metal compound based on antimony, known as tartar emetic, which hints at its toxicity.
Well, that sounds like a really unpleasant disease.
Indeed.
Particularly if you're having it untreated. And I can imagine it was really alarming. So the people you write about who were affected by de novonosis were the Marand of Papua New Guinea, and this was in the early 1900s. And as you explained, this is a sexually transmitted disease, and it was generally understood by people who were around it throughout the time of the epidemic that the Marand's behaviors contributed to the spread of disease, even though the theories as to how and why that was differed a lot. But before we get into that, I'm curious as to why in the book you refer to semen practices rather than what I might think of as sexual practices.
Yes, so this is a term that I found in the writings of an American anthropologist, Deborah Elliston. And the reason I chose it was that the Marand put semen to use in an extraordinary variety of different ways, and many of these had bore no relationship to eroticism or sexual desire. So examples would be they would put semen onto buds of plants to make them grow. One of their favorite traditional medicines involved a special type of banana combined with semen, and when they decorated women's skin with special scar patterns, they would put semen into the wounds, which they believed would make those wounds grow into prominent scars for decorative purposes. So because semen was being used in this way, I thought semen practices was a useful term. And I was anxious to steer clear of the sort of racist stereotyping of people of color as being hypersexual, particularly because in this case, semen was being harvested for purposes that were, often entirely independent of human sexual and reproductive health.
So the missionaries, there were a lot of missionaries there. And not surprisingly, they thought that the Marand's behavior was wanton and promiscuous, to say the least. So what was it in the nature of the semen practices that in your analysis contributed to the spread or to the increase in de novonosis?
The health risks for the Marand lay in their preferred manner of harvesting semen for ritual purposes. So they felt that if you were to collect semen from one man through masturbation, that lacked the potency that could be achieved if you combined the semen of several men with a certain amount of female vaginal fluid. So that required certain individual women to have serial intercourse with a number of men, and the woman would then collect the semen into a coconut receptacle, and then it would be used for ritual purposes. The numbers involved, we're pretty uncertain about, but I think the simplest way to explain this very unusual epidemic is to postulate that there was a steady escalation of this practice in response to various catastrophic events that were taking place among the Marind at that time. Another key use of semen which should be mentioned is that it was felt necessary to prepare the adolescent male for adult life. So while the mother breastfed her male infants, it was considered the role of a maternal uncle to take over this type of nurturing role when the male child reached adolescence. And then the milk of motherhood, as it were, was replaced by the semen of an uncle. And during the epidemic, the youngest age group affected were male adolescents, and they all had anal lesions. So this makes it clear that this semen feeding, as it were, had to involve anal sex.
So that's the kind of practice that it's very difficult for a Westerner to understand. And I think the missionaries certainly didn't. And another thing the Marin did was they practiced headhunting. And that attracted a lot of Western interest from the missionaries to even Hollywood film directors. Again, something very difficult for Westerners to understand or accept. So it's part of your thesis that the suppression of headhunting by colonial powers helped to spread the epidemic. And how did that occur?
It certainly seems counterintuitive that such a thing could have such consequences. But I think one has to appreciate the shocking upheaval that took place among the Marind when they were denied access to the headhunting ritual, which they considered to be absolutely vital to their own survival. We know that the Marians were plagued by infertility before this Donovanosis epidemic took off. And we also know that they were using the headhunting raids to acquire infants from neighboring communities and thus to compensate for their infertility in this manner. So when the Dutch banned headhunting, they didn't realize that they were denying access to children to the Marind. And so I'm certain that the semen practices then started to ramp up because they were desperately trying to restore the fertility of their own women. At the same time, the Marind were blaming themselves for failing to repel the Dutch from their land. And they believed that their spirit ancestors, known as the Demmer in Marin culture, needed to be appeased through increased ritual activity. And ritual activity among the Marians was almost synonymous with these semen practices.
And one of the great problems for the Marians, something you've touched on, was a persistent decline in fertility. But you write that Donovanosis very rarely causes infertility. So what was causing infertility, and how did the Marind and the people who were trying to reform them address it?
It's clear, certainly to me, that the infertility was present quite some time before the epidemic really took off. And if we look across Oceania as a whole at this time, we find there was actually widespread concern about depopulation. And the colonial administrators were all worrying that it would impact colonial activity. You know, there was a lot of labor recruitment in the Pacific to Queensland sugar plantations and so on. And it was very obvious that fertility right across the Pacific was falling quite dramatically. And the causes of this were hotly debated. There were people like W.H. Rivers who thought that it was the psychological impact of colonization that was leading to a fall in the desire to reproduce. But I think those ideas now have been pretty much set aside. There's far more evidence to suggest that, in fact, gonorrhea came into the Pacific region from Europe from the time of Captain Cook onwards. And we know that there were many island communities that had very relaxed attitudes to teenage sexuality, and this was exploited by, particularly initially by the whaling industry, which came, you know, in large numbers to the Pacific in the 19th century. And then subsequently, you had the colonial administrators often taking local women as mistresses and contributing to the spread of gonorrhea. And a very similar pattern has been observed in sub-Saharan Africa in the same period, that with the change in labor patterns, there was a lot of young single men away from their families, and prostitution starting to grow in these communities. So in Africa, very similar pattern of depopulation, of rise in prostitution, which in the African case laid the ground for the spread of HIV later on. So in terms of the response to this problem, or the problem of infertility, it was really the missionaries who led the response, but they did it unwittingly. They didn't realize that they were helping the infertility problem. So what they did was to experiment with what they called model villages. And this was a system that they developed in the Congo in Africa. And they would build a new village and encourage young, healthy married couples to settle in those villages, adopt a sort of more Western lifestyle, i.e., you know, Western clothing, Christianity, and so on. And this was primarily a way to win recruits to Christianity. But when they tried it out in New Guinea, they also noticed that the young women remained fertile. And so this was seized upon by the government as a way to tackle the infertility problem. They thought the missionary started off with just one or two model villages where women continued to have children, and the government said, we must roll this out right across the community because this is clearly a way that we can restore fertility.
And the infertility levels, I don't have the figures to hand, but it was really striking that
recall
the percentages of...
Well, some of the early missionaries did sort of house-to-house surveys of villages, and they found that there were at least 30% of women who'd never given birth, and those that had maybe had only had one child and then no more. So it was very striking, and certainly deaths were outnumbering births, and you know, so people were projecting that the marriage would be extinct within 7 years was one much quoted figure at the time.
And at what point was the headhunting really suppressed to the where it stopped happening?
So, I mean, it's fascinating the whole story is in some ways an accident of geography, because the Marins lived in the part of New Guinea that was controlled by the Dutch, and there was an international boundary with British New Guinea, and the Marins were raiding across that international boundary. So the British insisted that the Dutch do something about it. So they then built a garrison, and they stopped any Marines traveling in war parties in canoes along the coast. So stopping it on the coast was done quite quickly, and it wasn't difficult, but raiding inland went on for much, much longer. There's reports of headhunting, you know, up to the Second World War in remoter areas. But the Marines were, the majority population were living on the coast.
And so a real significant aspect of the headhunting was acquiring young children incorporate.
Absolutely. And in fact, after it was banned by the Dutch, the Marines continued to visit neighboring communities and try and buy children from them. So they stopped taking heads, and they would go along in their canoes with a supply of axes and trade goods and try and buy children.
And they raised those children as their own and treated them as members of the Marines.
That was the intention, but of course the Dutch government then stepped in and would confiscate abducted children and put them into mission schools.
So the book contains information, characterizations, a number of characters who were involved, really fascinating characters. And three of them in particular, you write about, were critically important in Western understanding of the Marin culture. And please forgive me or correct me if I pronounce these names wrong, because they are Swiss and Dutch. But one of them was the Swissman Paul Wurtz. And then there were two Dutchmen, Jan van Baal and Jan Verschuren. And Wurtz in particular had a sort of larger-than-life persona. He had a lot of unusual aspects of himself. But can you give a brief synopsis of each one of them, and then what they contributed and how they contributed it to Western knowledge of the Marand?
Certainly. So let's start off with Paul Wurtz, as he would be in Switzerland. And he was a real oddball. He was a man who dreamed of settling in a culture that was completely untouched by the Western world. And when he arrived in New Guinea, he was rather put out to find that the missionaries had already been there for 10 years. But at the same time, he must have benefited hugely from their presence, because, you know, they'd been studying the language, which is an extraordinarily difficult language, and they'd been studying the customs and actually publishing quite a lot of really interesting articles on them. So he built on that. He spent 3 years there, and he was unbelievably industrious. He worked really hard and gathered a massive information, so that everyone that followed him owed him a huge debt. And of course, he was there talking to people to whom the headhunting was pretty recent history. He was there in 1915, and you know, the Dutch had arrived in 1902. So there were plenty of older people to talk to who knew about the old lifestyle. So that's Paul Wurtz. Van Baal was a man who trained as a colonial administrator, and he was appointed to take the post in Morocco on the strength of his student thesis, which was actually a reanalysis of Wurtz's data. So he wrote an academic piece looking at Wurtz and sort of reanalyzing some of his, particularly the stuff on Marin myth that Paul Wurtz had collected. And but, you know, he remained in the colonial service. He rose to become the last governor of Dutch New Guinea. And so he was not a man who had time to do any field work. And in the 1960s, after he'd left New Guinea, he became a professor of anthropology, and he decided to sort of write the definitive work on the Marand. And this is a massive tome. It's over 1,000 pages. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he relied heavily on Wurtz. He cites him over 1,000 times in the book. And he basically analyzed absolutely everything missionaries, Wurtz and others had written about the Marand, and tried to sort of pull it all together and analyze it. And, you know, he's the acknowledged main authority on Marin culture today. But the interesting aspect of the way he worked was that he would write a chapter, and then he would send it to a Father Jan Verschuren, is the correct pronunciation. and this guy was the unsung hero of Marin anthropology, because he spent 30 years of his life there. He was the only really fluent speaker of their language. And he was in a position to verify a lot of what Wurtz had written and what Van Baal was trying to write. So, you know, as Van Baal sent chapters out to him, he would send masses of notes and corrections back. And he really should have been listed as co-author of the book, but he very modestly declined. He said, I think the title says, with the collaboration of Jan Verschuren. But, you know, he was hugely important, and he was much closer to the Marin than any other person that studied them. So I think that is something that needs to be recognised more, what an important part he played. So there we have three people. We have sort of the early work of Wiertz that laid the foundations for everything that followed. We then have Van Baal producing the definitive work, but doing the least field work. And then we have the Catholic priest who's been forgotten, but actually, you know, probably contributed more knowledge, more accurate and useful knowledge than any other single individual.
And is he the one that is remembered in Marin's culture today?
So the one who's remembered today is Petrus Vertenten.
Petrus Vertenten.
Yes. And Vertenten was quite an accomplished scholar in his own right. He produced one of the first dictionaries of the Marin language. But the reason Vertenten is remembered is that when the epidemic struck, he was incredibly diligent in raising awareness through his journalism, both in the Netherlands and in Jakarta, Batavia, as it was called at that time. And so he became a sort of almost a celebrity figure because he was saying there's this terrible epidemic, the Dutch government have got to do something. And he was vocal enough to trigger a debate in the Dutch parliament and get action. So he's remembered because he's the person who took the most trouble to make sure that the Marin eventually received help for the epidemic. And he has two statues. He has a statue in the Netherlands, in Belgium, where he was born in Hammer in Belgium. And then there's a second statue actually in the Marin village where he carried out a lot of his work.
And so all of these men went to that area for different reasons, and they weren't necessarily trained anthropologists. And they were, of course, they were coming from the colonial side of things. And yet they, in one sense, they were real advocates for the Marin. But do you have a sense now, looking back historically, what was the balance of how helpful were they to the Marin? Or, you know, they were interpreting a culture that we can't possibly know from the inside out. But they were also involved in policies that were set forth by the Dutch government, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, you could say that they were the humanitarian arm of the government. You know, the government were there to exploit New Guinea as a colony, you know, to find ways to generate income from it. There was trading in copra, there was trading in bird of paradise feathers at one point, and so on. But the government, the Dutch government at that time did have what they called an ethical policy, which was, you know, to look at education, welfare of indigenous peoples. But they basically delegated that to the missions. They thought the missions, you know, we'll provide a hospital for the expats. The missions can do healthcare for the indigenous people. So they were very closely with government, and they were, as it were, a sort of an arm of government.
Yeah. And just what was the Marin response to the treatment for de novonosis? Was that something that they welcomed, or they felt was threatening them, or what was their response to that?
I find it very hard to find any kind of firsthand testimony about how they responded. But knowing the disease as I know it, I mean, it's a pretty hideous disease, and the treatment was dramatically effective. You know, these horrible ulcers would shrink down, and you could would be healed within a couple of weeks of starting on treatment. So I think that once they'd seen the effectiveness of treatment, I think they started queuing up for it. But before then, they were, there were doctors trying to do surveys and doing surveys that involved genital examination, obviously a very difficult thing to do. And people were often run away when the doctors turned up. And the doctors didn't turn up alone. They turned up with an armed guard. You know, they would turn up with a police force to try and catch everyone and force them to be examined. There was it was very coercive and much disliked by the local population. But, you know, when the people who were really suffering and really sick with the disease were cured, you know, that I think that changed hearts and minds. And we know in other parts of the world, if you look at syphilis treatment campaigns, you know, or yours is closely related to syphilis, a single injection of penicillin and these horrible sores melt away. And in many parts of the world, that generated incredible belief in injections as the way to deal with any illness. The yours treatment campaigns, which were done on a large scale in many tropical countries, had a fantastic PR benefit, convincing people that, you know, there was a single injection that could actually cure everything at one point.
But for the donovanosis, pardon me, the early treatment, that was, they had to have frequent injections, didn't they?
Yes. I mean, it was very arduous. You needed, the regime was about 50 injections administered on alternate days. And in the intervening days, they would dress the wounds and look after other aspects of the illness. So it was, you know, it was a huge undertaking to treat thousands of people with intravenous injections over such an extended period.
Yeah, and they kept extensive data on it, didn't they? It seemed like they were documenting it pretty thoroughly.
Yeah, I mean, I wish there was more data because I know there are various reports that got lost, and there was a fire in Meraki that destroyed a lot of the records. So for me, I was disappointed to find how few detailed records had survived this episode.
Yeah. So there's something I'm really interested in. And towards the end of the book, you describe your difficulty in trying to find a single Marand voice to contribute to it. My impression reading the book was that there's a constant tension in the text based on the fact that you, who are a white British doctor, are telling the tale of an indigenous culture as it was interpreted largely by white European colonial interests. And even as some of those Europeans were advocating for the Marand, and even as you yourself are trying to reevaluate history more on the side of the Marand in the telling. And I think this is a dilemma that academia and wider society are becoming increasingly sensitive to. I wonder how you dealt with it as you worked on the book and how you feel about the end product.
Well, a very searching question and quite complex one to answer. I remain very conscious that, you know, I've written a book a bit like Van Baal did as an armchair scholar. I never got a chance to visit Meraki in person, although I tried extremely hard to set one up. And I've only met one individual of part Marin descent, and that was a few years back in Amsterdam. So the ideas I've laid out in the book, you know, represent my best understanding of how events unfolded. And like any scientist, you know, I would want to revise them if any new facts emerged. The issue of the Marin voice troubled me, you know, really right from the outset. And I tried to compensate by, you know, searching as diligently as I could for whatever testimony the Marins might have provided 100 years back. But sadly, you know, there seems to be pitifully little to unearth. Now, when my book was reviewed by anthropologists, they too said, you know, you really do need to have more of a Marin voice here if you possibly can. And they also said, I think you're being a bit too kind to the white protagonists, and could you please pay greater attention to the darker sides of imperialism and Orientalism and the behaviour of Catholic priests, which, you know, has come under fire a lot lately. So in response to that, I sort of redoubled my efforts to find a Marian voice. And here I struck lucky because, I wrote to all the people I knew who'd done field work in the area and said, look, can you help me? I really need to see if I can find someone to read my book or provide some more information. And luckily, one of these contacts was a guy called Bruce Olson. He's a linguist in Australia, and he'd done a PhD on the Marin language. And he told me that he had a manuscript that had been presented to him while he was doing his field work by a woman who said, I think this is important, and I think you should take it into your safekeeping because it's going to perish if it stays in our village. And it was a typescript, over 100 pages, closely annotated, which had been written by a relative of this woman. He's now deceased, called Yul Gebze. And the occasion for writing the manuscript was the Catholic Church was celebrating its 100th year of mission in Meraki and among the Marind. And this man was a very unusual for the Marind. He was someone who the Dutch had singled out as being intellectually very capable. And the Dutch, before the Indonesians took over, were trying to build up an educated elite among them, in West Papua, in the hope that eventually it would become independent, like the other half of the island, which is now Papua New Guinea. So Yul Gebze went to university in Java, and he was a very able linguist. He was able to read everything that the anthropologists and the missionaries had written about his people. And as he did so, he became increasingly angry. He felt that the Marind had been written about very disrespectfully, they'd been misunderstood, a lot of the rituals had been misinterpreted. So there's this sort of, in this manuscript, there's an explosion of anger about the sort of racist treatment and the discrimination that had come to the Marin from their colonial administrators. It did have a big impact on me, just seeing this anger, seeing the pain that this man felt about the way the Marind had been treated. So it ended up that, sort of worked my way through this manuscript and I wrote a new chapter for the book. I mean, the book had already been accepted for publication, but I thought this was so important that it's the ideal way to present the Marind point of view. And I was so glad that this late development in writing the book, that I had the opportunity to do that. So going back to the way I tackled the story, I remember when I returned to the UK and started to use the story as a case study, that I was very focused initially on the medical aspects. You know, it did seem on the surface of it to be a model intervention, that there'd been meticulous case finding and treatment carried out, and the model village program was highly effective in terms of keeping young uninfected couples away from the older communities who were still suffering from infection. So in terms of, you know, it was a very effective way to control the epidemic. But what I didn't appreciate early on is just the cost to the Marins, that, you know, they hated the medical surveys. They hated the fact that they'd been deprived of headhunting. And so, you know, as time went on, I became increasingly aware of the heavy price they had paid. And I feel that, you know, the Marin today are in a pretty bad place, and I think a lot of that has to do with it's the legacy of decades of discrimination and lack of true concern for their welfare. I think, you know, if my book helps readers to understand that when you're dealing with an epidemic, It's not just a job for doctors and public health experts. It needs a kind of multidisciplinary approach that is collaborative and involves dialogue with the affected community rather than the sort of coercive measures that were used here. I think the book would be worthwhile if the way I've highlighted these injustices, if I can bring that, make people in other parts of the world more aware of what's happened here, that would be a good outcome for the book.
And so is this a sort of, would this be an evolving of your own consciousness maybe? Because you came at it, as you say, originally you were interested in the story of a public health story,
yeah,
as it were. And you're not an anthropologist, and you state that, and you sourced anthropologists, and then you obviously got peer reviewers who were anthropologists.
Yeah.
And how much was this sort of a broadening of your own consciousness as you went about working on the book?
Oh, very much so. You know, I'm a different person as a result of writing this book, and I've always been a bit left leaning, but I had no idea of the full extent of the dark side of imperialism. Let's put it that way. I was brought up in Britain. There's a map I illustrate in the book, you know, that hung on the wall of my bedroom, which was a map of the British Empire with this massive red, you know, centered on a tiny little British island. And, you know, I was brought up to be proud of what the British Empire was. But I, at that time, knew nothing about, you know, some of the terrible things that went on in the name of you know, the civilizing mission was what we were always taught at school. But in fact, you know, there was a lot of exploitation and some very harsh treatment in the British Empire, as it was in the Belgian Congo and the German Empire, the Dutch Empire. They all had their darker side.
Yeah. And you write about that, you know, in the book. You sort of describe, particularly when you get to that later chapter that you added, and you describe your own process, in arriving at that and trying to incorporate other perspectives. So I think it's a really valuable addition to that, the literature on looking at public health stories and imperialism. Because there are a lot of those out there, and the ones I've seen are mostly written by anthropologists who have. So it's really interesting to see your perspective coming at it from a sort of different angle.
Yeah, yeah.
As it were, given your background. So the book ends on quite a sobering note, and I'll just read the last sentence, mm-hmm. which is, "The manner in which the Marins are being treated today is uncivilized and shames those who condone or ignore it." So would you just briefly describe the situation for the Marin now?
Well, in two words, pretty grim. They are marginalized, they're discriminated against, and to a considerable extent, they're now malnourished in this large swathe of land that they once owned. After the epidemic that I write about, there was a sort of a little bit of development. The number of schools increased, attempts to develop agriculture mostly failed. And then once Indonesia had taken over West Papua from the Dutch, large numbers of migrants started to be settled in Marin territory. And they now outnumber the Marin. They benefit from most of the inward investment at the expense of the Marin. And then more recently, large tracts of land have been coercively sold off to agribusiness interests. And the rainforests are disappearing, being replaced by palm oil plantations. So there's pollution arising from that. There's certainly a huge loss of biodiversity, and the Marin's traditional hunting grounds are shrinking dramatically. The incoming population get all the employment opportunities. And it's such a change. I mean, before the Dutch arrived, you know, this was a land with very abundant food sources. There was you know, there were savanna-like areas where you could hunt wallabies. There were huge coconut forests. There were sago stands. They could fish from the rivers. There was seafood on the seashore and so on. And all of these resources have now shrunk dramatically. There's been a land grab, and the Maroons are in a pitiable state in a good number of their villages. I should add that this story about recent developments has been really well told in a second book about the Maroon that came out this year, written by anthropologist Sophie Chow, and it's called In the Shadow of the Palms. So I'm hoping that the combined impact of our two books, which, you know, look at the past and look at the present, will enable readers to see the urgency of doing something more positive on behalf of this very neglected and troubled people.
Mm. Yeah, that was quite felicitous, your two books coming out at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that it is interesting that you look back and there's the public health success story of history, but everything that's been wrought by the other part of the story.
Yeah.
And is ongoing. So, John, we have taken up a lot of your time today, but I wanted to ask you before we go, because I know you're working on something completely different. Would you tell us what your next project is?
Okay. Well, briefly, I've been a musician throughout my life. And one of the things that I did when I returned to Britain was to set up a piano trio ensemble, and that led eventually to my taking on a position at the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge, which is a very famous museum, which runs a Sunday concert series. So I took over the running of that concert series, and then the museum appointed a new director who asked me whether I could relate music programs more closely to items in the collections. And so that led to me looking for connections between composers and artists, and producing a sort of new type of program notes that instead of analyzing the music simply, actually talked about the composer, the artist, and how the two connected and how they related to each other. And so the new book is an anthology of essays, short essays, illustrated with a fine artwork relating a piece of music to a work of art.
So a holistic sort of analysis.
Yes, I mean, as with Tick Maraukey, I go off down a lot of rabbit holes, and I just love exploring unusual connections between things.
Yeah, which is really fascinating.
So that is, you know, that's written. I'm now back at square one in terms of trying to find a publisher that will show some interest.
Well, good luck with that. Sometimes the most difficult part of writing a book. Everyone, I want to remind you the book is Tick Maraukey, An Epidemic Like No Other, published by Melbourne University Press by Dr. John Richens. And it's an absolutely fascinating read. And John, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Well, thank you too, Rachel, for a very, very enjoyable interview.